Welcome to the Strangers and Aliens podcast.
Strangers. To boldly say what needs to be said.
Would you be a stranger or an alien? Or would you be a strange alien?
The truth is out there. I am your father's best friend's plumber. Superman.
Wonder Woman.
Heroes. Villains. Captain Picard versus Captain Kirk.
Do you think that there's room in sci-fi for God? The very first thing that God did was that he created something, so we have a creative God.
This is Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the podcast. This is Strangers and Aliens. I'm Ben, one of the sci-fi guys, and joining me are...
Dr. Jace.
We never have a way to do this. It's always like whoever can jump in first, and then the other one doesn't know if they're stepping on each other's toes. And
yeah,
it's always a lot of fun.
You stepped on my toes. I was saying my name, and then you jumped in, and then
I did.
You stepped on his toes to say one of us is worried about stepping on toes.
Exactly.
Well, that's because I always feel like I'm doing that. So we should script these. Let's just start all over again with a new script.
Yes. And let's be very robotic about it.
Okay, ready? Okay, here we go. Take two. Hello. Welcome to Strangers and Aliens. Oh, you stepped on my toes.
It doesn't
work. Robotic toes, so it's not
okay. Well, I'm Ben Avery, and I write comic books, and I like science fiction. That's why I'm here. And Dr. Jace and Steve, if you'd give a quick introduction to yourselves. We'll start with Dr. Jace.
Yeah.
Well, hello, I'm Dr. Jace.
Good enough. And she's kidding. Sorry.
Fine. No, I'm not going to talk.
I couldn't not do that. So
that's all right. No,
okay, go ahead.
I'm done. No. Well, I am an author, and I teach at Regent University. I teach. I get to teach people about movies and stuff. But yeah, Steve. I'm an actor, and I like to act. So, Steve, you can take it from there.
Cool. I like to act, too, but I'm not an actor. My name's Steve, and I am also a writer, although much less published than my two colleagues here. But not that I don't want to be. So if anybody wants to publish my stuff and really enjoys my insane ramblings, please give me a call or text or email or whatever, and I will follow up on that.
I will vouch for Steve on this point. When he's writing a story, he does not ramble as much as when he's writing, say, about Star Wars or
Steve. Maybe you should get in contact with Student Z, and maybe he's a publisher. Help get you going.
We'll get to Student Z soon enough. We'll get to that momentarily. Well, I shouldn't say momentarily because we have a whole conversation we want to get through before we get to that.
Yeah. But we love Student Z. Just to let you know.
So we've had a lot of topical ideas, and we've had some people even suggest some topics like Doctor Who, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Those were two suggestions from a listener. Which is basically me pretending to be someone else. But yeah, we've got some ideas for like specific things. Harry Potter's another one, which I'm going to destroy all credibility here. I have only read one Harry Potter book and seen two Harry Potter movies.
Loser.
When I read Harry Potter, well, we don't need to get into that. So we've had some specific ideas of specific specific titles, but we did just spent two episodes on Star Wars. So we were thinking, what can we talk about that's not so specific? And let's get broad again. You know, we started out with why sci-fi. And so I think that today's topic, we're going to be talking about science fiction versus fantasy. And this is not something that like Captain Kirk versus Captain Picard, where we're actually would fight about how the fight would go down.
Which is actually a pretty easy fight, but never mind.
Yeah, because fantasy would win, like in heartbeat.
Well, but the idea being, you know, how are they different? How are they similar? And what kind of stories can you do with one that you can't do with the other, and vice versa? And not that you can't do certain things with one genre, but you know, they lend themselves toward different things. So I thought I'd start with actually a quote from Isaac Asimov, the master of all this, and then, yeah, turn over the floor to
Why don't you explain who that is for those who are the casual sci-fi fantasy fan?
Well, I'm going to right here. Isaac Asimov is
a writer. I didn't mean to step on you or anything.
My toes hurt bad enough as it is. Isaac Asimov is the grandmaster science fiction writer in a lot of ways. I think some people might argue that there are other writers who
Jules Verne
more influential than he is, but he's definitely up there. And he's written some of the classics of science fiction that are the go-to for a lot of the fans. He also edited a science fiction magazine for a long time. He's not alive anymore, but when he was alive, he had this magazine that it was a science fiction magazine, but he wrote this article basically responding to readers who objected to putting fantasy stories in their science fiction magazine. Basically, you got peanut butter in my chocolate kind of thing. And together they didn't taste great, according to them.
That makes complete sense.
See, yeah, I'm old. And that's why it makes sense. If you're old, you know you got peanut butter in my chocolate, and together,
got chocolate in my peanut butter.
It tastes great.
Now people are like, "Yeah, that's Reese's. That's pretty much a common thing."
That was the idea. That was the commercial.
Yeah.
For Reese's. So this is what Isaac Asimov said. He said basically, in a very broad sense, this is quoting now: all fiction and a great deal of nonfiction is fantasy, and that it is drawn from the imagination. We in our group, however, give the word a special meaning. It is not the plot of a story that makes it a fantasy, however imaginative that plot may be. It is the background against which the plot is played out that counts. And then he says, to give specific examples, the Foundation series, which is a series he wrote, is science fiction, and Lord of the Rings is fantasy. To be more general about it, spaceships and robots are science fiction, while elves and magic are fantasy. So he kind of paints a very broad picture of the differences between them. And then you have Star Wars, which literally is the Reese's peanut butter cup of science fiction and fantasy. So I thought we'd start out just kind of talking about fantasy. What is it and what do we like about it? And what are some fantasy series and books that we like? So I'm going to turn it over to Steve now. Steve, thoughts?
Yes, thoughts. My thoughts. Here's here are my thoughts. I think when you have something that's as broad as fantasy, I think in my thinking anyway, science fiction falls under fantasy, because it is fantastic writing. It's fantastic literature. It doesn't exist outside of the realm of that story. It's future fantasy. It's not, you know, past fantasy like Lord of the Rings type of a thing. But even saying that, you can have something set on a different planet where it could be in the far future. Of course, it seems like it's in the past because of the whole context of it. So it bleeds into each other so much.
Star Wars is a long time ago, so that would be in the past.
It was, but it wasn't originally envisioned as being a long time ago. There was some points in the script where it was set in the future, in our future.
Right. But what it ended up being,
ended up being in the past.
So why do we have to delineate between the two then?
I think delineating between the two is purely aesthetics and purely how someone feels towards it, how it affects people. Science fiction affects people differently than fantasy does. You know, there was a time in my life where I couldn't get enough science fiction, but fantasy was just like, because it hadn't reached me yet. And it took something, you know, very specific for me to start getting into it and to start understanding it a little bit better. And now it almost seems like fantasy is creeping over and taking over the sense that I had, that the feel that I got from science fiction, it's different now that in a fantasy setting. And it goes into superhero type stuff too, where you have, you know, superhero comic book, that type of thing is a fantasy as well. Super powered fantasy instead of super science fantasy or super magical fantasy.
I would actually disagree on that note. Because it's depending, I guess, if you're talking about the original comics where everyone's powers were magical, then yeah, then it'd be fantasy. But if you go into the more recent, like X-Men, Spider-Man, that has a science component to it.
Is that the difference?
It's arguable.
Jace, is that the difference between the two? Science fiction has science?
See, for me, I like a broader term for each. I don't like how some people try to really delineate between the two. For me, when I look at science, I think of a science component. Fantasy just does not. Like, I would think of fairy tales as fantasy, Lord of the Rings as fairy tales, and I think that you're right that Star Wars is kind of a hybrid in that it doesn't even really talk about science, at least the original trilogy. When they get into the midichlorians or whatever you call those guys, then it's like a pseudoscience.
Yeah.
So for me, I like a broader term. I like a broader definition of science fiction versus fantasy, as far as one is science focused, i.e. Star Trek. You know, it's a very, you know, science is a part of it. Even, you know, Spider-Man has a science to his origin story. And then fantasy is, Lord of the Rings, Narnia, those types of stories.
Well, it brings up an interesting thing with the Marvel movies that have been coming out, where they have Thor, which is a great superhero fantasy. And I love how it basically takes Superman, mix in Lord of the Rings, and you get Thor.
Yeah.
The movie. I love that. And then you have Iron Man, which is meant to be grounded in reality. It could happen. I mean, when I say it could happen, I mean the science might be really, really flimsy. But, you know, a guy putting on armor so he can fight other guys in armor that's mechanical and computerized and nanotech and all that stuff.
Then, exactly.
And then you have the mix. You have them going together into the Avengers movie that's coming out this summer, where I think it's the summer, right? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think so, yeah.
And what's the guy's name that directed Iron Man?
Favreau?
Yeah. He had a problem with that because he worked so hard to make this kind of gritty reality sort of in Iron Man. And then how do you bring into that universe the magic of Thor, for example? And then you bring in Captain America, which kind of had both in some ways, but
less magic-y, but definitely with the Hydra element in Captain America. I found Captain America very interesting with that element because it took something that typically, like a cult leader will, you know, say this thing has magical properties and blah 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 blah, and obviously it's bunk, and they get, you know, figured out that it's bunk. But here's someone who believed in these magical properties or whatever, but it was true. I mean, you don't get that in our world. In our world, when you have someone who believes something is magical, it turns out that the person is usually insane because that doesn't exist here, or at least the way that it usually plays out in films and stuff. And now you have someone who believes it, and in this reality, in this universe, it does exist. So instead of being insane, this person is linked into something that exists. And it really recast the Red Skull in a different light, for me anyway. And conversely, in the Thor movie, this is one of the issues that I have with the Thor movie. When they're describing magic, they basically say it's science that hasn't been discovered yet.
It's that Arthur C. Clarke
idea
of anything that looks, I mean, anything that's advanced technologically enough looks like magic to someone who's more primitive.
Right. Which I take great issue with, although it would have that effect. Future science would have that effect. I think it completely eviscerates the whole reason why magic is in stories, and I think it's a completely different conversation. I'd like to do it as a a self-existing show, just a, you know, a show in and of itself
about magic.
Talking about magic. So I won't really get into it now, but magic exists for real literary reasons. And if you take it out of that context, especially like Thor, which is deep, deep in this magical sense, and if you just say, well, it's just science that you haven't discovered yet, it really dumbs it down.
Yeah,
right. But so that's just a literary device. I mean, isn't it just a way of, instead of having to explain?
It's a modern literary device that doesn't explain it.
Why does it have to be explained?
Well, exactly. It doesn't really have to be explained, but when they do explain it that way, it minimizes what it really is supposed to be there for, and it doesn't explain it at all.
But they're explaining it for Thor. They're trying to do that so it would fit more in with like the Iron Man, the universe that could have an Iron Man like it has, and a Captain America like it has, and the Hulk like it has, which because they're putting them all together.
Yeah.
And it's not the first time it's been done. I mean, Stargate. Good grief.
Oh, right, yeah.
I really enjoy Stargate, but I was talking to a guy from Norway who wanted to do a story. He's an artist, and he wanted to do a story with me about how it turns out that the Greek gods were all aliens, and and I said, well, yeah, just like Stargate. Now, he had never heard of or seen Stargate, so he didn't know that someone had already done this like really, really well too. So,
well, Ben, let me ask you this. Because, you know, we talked about the first part on kind of the differences between fantasy and science fiction, at least what we view as the difference.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, do you guys have a preference? And, you know, I'll just tell you, like, for me, you know, I love Star Trek. I love Star Wars. But when it comes down to the book, my favorite books of all time is Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
And I love science fiction, or at least what I interpret to be science fiction.
Right.
But when I read Lord of the Rings, I remember being in Return of the King and looking at the book and being halfway through going, wow, this is exciting. I still got a whole nother half of the book to go. And then a chapter later, it ends. Because I didn't realize that the whole second half of the book was like histories and so I was devastated. Like, I felt like I had lost my friends. I had locked myself in a room for 2.5 weeks and read through all of the books. And then all of a sudden it just ended. And I was so upset.
Now, how old were you when you were doing that?
I was like 19.
So you must have loved the film of Return of the King, where it just kept ending and ending.
No. I was upset because they didn't even get the right ending. I kept wanting to see the hobbits go back and tear down Saruman.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. I really have a problem with that, but that's another discussion for another day. But so for you, your go-to would be a fantasy book. Is that what you're...
Well, as far as books go, then, yeah, I mean, there's none other. I mean, because, like, I'll be honest, I love Mr. Burns. I love a lot of his stuff. But my least favorite science fiction book that I've read recently is The Mysterious Island. I was so bored out of my mind because almost the entire book, you're reading, like, a history of how these castaways rebuild a society. They built a clay stove.
Wait. This Jules Verne's Mysterious Island?
Yes.
This is it a sequel or a prequel to 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea?
It's a sequel. It's a sequel.
Okay.
And so it was so boring. It was just about rebuilding science. And I'm like, this isn't science fiction. This is like science history. If I would have known that this was like I know later on it gets a little bit more, but I was so bored. So for me, my favorite fantasy sci-fi book of those two genres is Lord of the Rings. So far, my least favorite of recent memory is The Mysterious Island, which is, by the way, the movie has nothing to do with the book, almost, except there's an island and there's water.
And it's so mysterious.
Island and water, which you kind of need to make an island.
So how about you guys? What's your favorite book, sci-fi fantasy? What's your least favorite book, sci-fi fantasy?
Well, I'll tell you, honestly, when it comes to like watching something, I enjoy both. Because with a movie, as long as there's something going on the screen that's interesting, I can run with it. Yeah. When it comes to reading, I do tend to read more fantasy, probably. Of course, I do read a lot of comic books, and so then you have your that's both. I really do believe that comic books, especially Marvel and DC, I should say, superhero stuff, superhero stories are like Star Wars. It really is a combination of the two.
Yeah, I agree.
But if I'm reading I just started reading a book by Frank Herbert's son. It's Frank Herbert who wrote Dune. His son worked on some Dune sequels and that. But this is something that's original with his son. And I thought, okay, this is cool. This is, I'm going to read this. And I just started reading it and I couldn't. And a well-written, engaging science fiction book, I can follow and I can run with that. I can go with that. But a lot of times science fiction does get caught up in the science. And that bothers me because I feel like I'm being, like you just said, you know, this is history. This is, you know, this is explaining all these details that I'm really not all that interested in.
Right.
And with fantasy, you have that as well, but it's not like, it's not real. You know, it's explaining the rules of magic, which, you know, I think can be more interesting because it is more made up.
Yeah, in fantasy, you have to explain a little bit of how this world or this universe of whatever book or movie you're watching so that the audience understands it. Or science, or science fiction, tends to spend a lot of time explaining those rules and laws.
Yeah, yeah. And so I'm trying to think of the last, you know, good thing that I've read. I love Narnia, though. And here's an interesting one, though. C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. Mm-hmm. What's interesting to me is that C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy starts out as science fiction. The first book, he tries to write a rocket from Earth to the moon and how it would work and these details about gravity and you know, force and all these different little things. And then you get to the planet and it's these details about the planet, which the planet is interesting. But he included the Mars canals, even though at that point in our actual history, we knew they weren't real.
Right.
But then you get to Perelandra, the second book, where he goes to Venus, and how does he get them there? By angels. Angels put the guy in a box and carry him to Venus. And he actually said in an article that he had learned his lesson. And that when it came to the next book, he was just going to get the guy there and get the story going and not worry about trying to make it that literal sci-fi.
Right.
So I do tend toward fantasy, although I enjoy science fiction, but I and in my writing as well, I tend toward fantasy. And I got eviscerated with a review on one of my kid's book that I did, where it was science based, but sci-fi time travel stuff, but my understanding of quantum mechanics was not good enough to
your annual plug.
I didn't say what the title was. Time flies.
Time flies.
So, Steve, what about you? What's your most favorite and your least favorite of all?
Wow. Well, if it comes to fantasy, usually I will stay with Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and fairy tales. I love the old fairy tales.
Are you talking about like the Brothers Grimm, or are you talking about like Christian Andersen?
Brothers Grimm, Christian Andersen, George MacDonald, no relation. Those ones, the ones that stand out, the ones that are still true to that form. I find very few modern fairy tales that hold up to that. There are some that are good, there are some that are well done, but none that really hold up to that. That tradition where it's just more innocent. It's not written, or it doesn't seem like it's written for a specific audience or for a specific impact. It's written because this is how they were told. This is the story. Here it is. You take the story as it's given to you. Nowadays, I think it's more about manipulating the audience or trying to get a trick ending or a twist or something at the end, which is good for what it's worth, but I really like the older stuff. Probably because I'm an elderly gentleman, And
you're not that old.
Elderly, Steve. Anyway.
You're not that old. Elderly. No, or according to Student Z, geezerly.
Yeah.
Geezerly. No,
Steve, is there one, though, that is your least favorite of all sci-fi or fantasy that you just think is a complete waste of time?
I think any fantasy story that dumbs down the magic to a point where it loses its literary convention. And like I said, this is a thing I want to take in a different episode, so I won't really go into it. But when you have someone who can use both black magic and white magic at the same time, or someone who can do incantations plus invocations at the same time, and you're mixing two things that shouldn't be mixed.
So your issue is because since fantasy, I don't know if we've actually mentioned it here, fantasy tends to have a little bit more of a metaphor or allegory. Your issue is kind of, from what you said in previous podcasts, is kind of a duality of good versus evil, and that a character can't do both good versus evil in that context. Is that what you're getting at?
It's a little deeper than that, but for this conversation, I think we can leave it at that. Yeah, the metaphor is lost there. And when it is, and I'm reading, and I can't get past that point, it's just, to me, I'm like, why put magic in there? Why don't you just have something completely different?
But that's a lot of modern literature anyway, where there isn't the strong, good versus evil and that sort of thing. And I take issue with a lot of people who are trying to write superhero stories because they don't believe in good versus evil.
Right.
It's hard to write a story about good versus evil if you don't believe in good or evil.
Right.
I think that's we were talking earlier, Ben, you'd asked us how we would define science fiction versus fantasy. And I think, in general, some new things are going on, but it seems to me that fantasy, there's a lot more room for spiritual, biblical, allegory, symbolism, and science fiction. It seems to go almost exclusively humanistic.
In a lot of ways it does, yeah.
Well, do these lend themselves to certain kinds of storytelling then?
I find when I'm writing fantasy, I'm able to take spiritual concepts and show them in a positive light. And that's how the story plays out. There's a positive spiritual concept here. It's positive and you have an ending. When I do science fiction, it's usually contrasting. And I take something that's a spiritual truth and show how it is not happening because of the technology or culture that it's based on or whatever, and then show it sort of in a negative light that way. Not that technology is wrong or science is wrong or anything like that, but just that truth that I'm trying to tell, how it's trying to be circumvented by the science or the technology or whatever, but then it breaks through. So characters may fail, but the truth succeeds.
Let me ask you guys this. All right, I'm going to ask you two questions, and just off the top of your head, you just shoot them at me as best you can
without stepping on toes, right?
Yeah, without stepping. No, I don't care if you step on toes,
okay,
or hands or ears. All right, I want you to think fantasy only. Think of fantasy books and movies and or movies that you think have strong Judeo-Christian spiritual meanings to them. Not that all the characters are fluffy, but that the truths that you can pull spiritual Christian truths out of these movies. So just fantasy. So just start list, and I'll stop you. I might have to cut you off, but so just start naming whatever comes to mind. You don't have to explain them. You don't have to explain them. Just throw them.
Excalibur.
Lord of the Rings, Narnia.
Narnia, Lord of the Rings. I do think there's some Harry Potter in Harry Potter.
Harry Potter, yeah.
If it's
done correctly.
Some in Dark Crystal.
The King Arthur stuff, if it's done in that tradition. Beowulf.
What about modern stuff?
Yeah, so I'm trying to think
more
of
modern stuff. Yeah, the modern Beowulf movies, no. I don't think they had anything to do with Christianity.
There's something to be found in like Wizard of Oz as well.
Yeah.
I would take issue with that, but you would know more than that.
Now, on science fiction, if we take the more hardline view of science fiction that it's based on, you know, science, what science fiction stories do you think have Judeo-Christian spiritual undertones?
The space trilogy.
Judeo-Christian,
not just religious, but Judeo-Christian, right?
Yeah, Judeo-Christian, because you're saying that the space trilogy, when Ben was saying that there was more fantasy in that than science fiction in the first book, but fantasy in the other, so that's debatable if we take that perspective of science fiction. But can you think of any science fiction?
Star Trek V.
The Breads and Circuses episode of Star Trek, the original series.
Solaris is one. There's some interesting... It's not intentional, though, I don't think.
I say that because for me, I mean, it seems like the same thing. I had a far easier time coming up with fantasy things that, you know, even if you go into fairy tales that Steve was saying, that have a stronger Christian allegorical message that you can pull out of it versus science fiction.
Which is very humanistic, or at the very least, it is all embracing. You know,
difference, though, is, you know, science fiction is about kind of what is and what could be. And it's thinking, you know, you got the humanism factor, but it's also thinking about, okay, well, where are we going as a race of humans? Mm-hmm. And so it is more focused on the possibilities and the external, I think. And with fantasy, it's still focused on the external, but like you're saying about the allegory aspect of things, you've got, you know, swords and good versus evil and magic rings and creatures that represent different aspects of humanity.
So do you think the convention of fantasy is easier to be able to tell those kind of stories?
I definitely think it's easier to tell those kind of stories. Yeah. I think that that's...
Do you think that it just depends on... Because if you took a Christian... I had a chance to study in college with George Smoot, who was one of... He's a Nobel Prize winner. One of the most... Stephen Hawking credited him with one of the greatest discoveries in the last 100 years. He was helped develop the Hubble telescope. And I took a special program with him. And it was about creation, and the conversation of creation versus evolution came up. And he made the comment, and I don't know if he still feels this way or not, that there are times when people who believe in creation are people who believe in pure, straight evolution, that there was no design, no, it was just by accident, actually have to go on more faith than those who believe that there was an intelligent design.
Yeah, definitely.
So what in my thing is that science fiction completely depends on the worldview of the person. Because if the worldview is purely that it's all about humanity, you know, this whole concept, be the best you can be. Well, that's not a Christian worldview. That's a very humanistic worldview. Because, you know, what if you're a jerk? Be the best jerk you can be.
I've tried. I've really tried.
Yes, I know, Steve. but we're supposed to be the best, you know, if humanity is left to our own devices, the future is not bright, which I think is very indicative of science fiction stories in general, because stories where the human race, like Star Trek, I love Star Trek, but the concept that we will get better and we will improve and we will eradicate hunger and all these kind of things. Well, you know, if that were completely true, then it wouldn't just be Earth, you know, because all of a sudden Earth is perfect and everywhere else is not. To me, that's a very hollow future. And that's the one part of Star Trek that never fully rang true for me.
And it's, you know, if you look at like Deep Space Nine, I'm watching through that right now. They have a bunch of episodes where they actually do commentary on that, you know, where they talk about when you're living in paradise, it's easy to make the right decisions and that sort of thing. And the Federation is paradise. But I do think in some ways, you know, we've talked about...
Is that true, though? What? Sometimes in paradise, it's harder because you get lazy and you you get sports, you know, in America over the last 20 years, I mean, it's getting tough recently, but we've had extreme, extreme financial prosperity as far as in general, and it's definitely far from perfect.
No, but that's not what they're saying. What they're saying is in the Federation, it's easy to see things in black and white because everything's good and happy and shiny. But if you're outside of that and there is gray areas outside, you know, that they don't mention, like Star Trek Next Generation, none of the grit that you find in like Deep Space Nine is there, because Deep Space Nine was really trying to be something different and right. trying to do more human stories and more and kind of not poke holes in Gene Roddenberry's vision of where humanity could go, but explore some of the ramifications of that. But what I was about to say there was, you know, with fantasy and with Star Wars and with science fiction and all these different things, you know, in Star Wars, we all, I think, found some spiritual ideas and spiritual truths that weren't intended to be there, but that couldn't help but be there because of the story that was being told. Specifically, you know, the good versus evil aspect of things, where there's supposed to be balance and that kind of thing, but that ultimately George Lucas wants us to root for the good guys, you know, and that. And with Star Trek, I think part of what Gene Roddenberry is striving for and yearning for when he was coming up with that idea goes back to just our human innate desire to be like God and to, you know, to have that perfection and to have that paradise. And it's kind of like with C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, where before C.S. Lewis became a believer, basically Tolkien and some other guys were saying, well, why do these stories of the sacrificial God in the Norse mythology appeal to you? It appeals to you because there is an innate understanding in your very being that there's truth there and that there has to be sacrifice in order for, you know, good to prevail and just some of that different kind of thing there.
Yeah. Romans talks about how we as human beings, we know the truth, but we suppress it. And overcoming that suppression in some people and bringing them to a point where, you know, you can see these threads coming through. You do appreciate sacrifice in these myths. You do appreciate these little things, and bringing that through can come a huge way in overcoming a person suppressing Christianity and the reality of Jesus. So that's a really good point there.
I think, Ben, what you were saying about the spiritual truths is, I just think that I would love to see more science fiction have some deeper meanings. Because I love Star Trek, but Gene Roddenberry, I believe I saw an article where he stated that that all of the characters in Star Trek were supposed to be atheists because they were too smart to believe in God, which is interesting because in one of the original series, Spock has a quote, like a little monologue at the end where he actually speaks about Jesus, which I thought was very interesting. I can't remember the name of that episode.
Well, but Star Trek V, where, you know, basically Kirk...
I doubt any God who inflicts pain for his own pleasure.
But they do admit there's the possibility of something more there.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of these people that we're talking about don't really know the power in the stories that they're talking about. Like we talked about the original trilogy in Star Wars. Well, obviously, it almost seems like a different worldview in the new trilogy. And the same is true for, like, The Matrix. The Matrix, the first one, has kind of these kind of savior kind of looks to it. And then all of a sudden, the second and third installment of Matrix is like, what is this? This went from, like, a Judeo-Christian view to, like, a Buddhist, or I don't know what this is, hedonistic view.
It just stands it on its ear, and just it changes the whole dynamic of it. So when you watch the first one, and then you watch the second two, it completely recasts the first one. And you say to yourself, how could that have been the story in the first
one? Steve, I disagree. I just ignore that the second two even exist.
There you go. I agree with you there. I also disagree. But I think one of the good things, the interesting things that you brought up was, you know, seeing what could be in these productions, like Firefly or Serenity. I was watching it, and you had the character of Book, who had a deep history, but you didn't really know what was going on. And then in the movie, it just completely degenerates that character, brings it down to a base where he's actually going against, I mean, if you're thinking about him as a Christian, someone who's actually turned his life around and repented and put his faith in Jesus Christ and all that stuff, if he has done that, and at the very end he tells Mal, just go and do something, you know?
It doesn't matter what you do, just
do it. I was completely blown away by that. It just recast the entire thing, and I'm like, so this character, basically, you don't care about his spiritual message. You don't care about his growth or his impact on the group, because at the very end, the very last thing that he can possibly do, unless he's written letters or something to them, retracts that or whatever.
Well, the very last thing he can do as a character. Don't get away. We should have a whole episode on Firefly and Serenity.
Yeah, definitely.
I think that some people get caught up in the whole idea of something being just a story, too. And I don't think there is such a thing as just a story. I think storytellers don't realize the power that their stories have. And I think if they understood that they would kind of take a step back and say, okay, well, when I'm doing The Matrix 2 and 3, maybe there are some truths that are part of this that I'm just trying to not even think about or acknowledge, or when I'm talking about this character of Book. Although there is a graphic novel that gets into his background that kind of, I like it, and it's Joss Whedon approved, but I think you get kind of, I think a lot of storytellers, especially in science fiction and fantasy, where they just say, well, it's just a story. I don't have to worry about the consequences of telling a story in this way, kind of going back to Steve's problem with modern fantasies, which have, you know, it's just all gray and no black and white.
Yeah.
So, final thoughts, or should we just move on to our mailbag?
Final thoughts real quick is, you're absolutely right, Ben. Every TV show, every movie has a worldview. I actually teach this in class. There's different lenses in which to interpret movies or stories in general. And you can't get beyond the worldview of a story. And so when you guys, if you're watching a movie, for listeners, when you watch a movie, read a book, just don't look at it as just a consumer where you don't actually thinking about it. If the message in it is skewed, you need to recognize that it's skewed. Because right now, media is the number one influence in young people's lives more than their parents. And they are literally, movies, TV shows, books are determining people's value systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to be very cautious. And I think that's one of the reasons why we do this podcast a little bit differently, through not just intellectual, but also from a spiritual perspective, because you have to process entertainment that way.
And I think that's the value of entertainment in some ways, is that you are processing and you are taking a look at your own worldview as you're looking at other worldviews.
But not everybody does that. In fact,
I totally agree that does that. I'm just saying that is a value to it, is that, okay, yeah, I can watch something that is against my worldview, but am I an active watcher? Am I thinking as I'm watching, or am I just imbibing as I'm watching? Am I just...
I think people need to go to the next step, not just realizing that there's something off, but figuring out why it's off.
Right.
Or why it's on, too. I mean, that's the idea.
Absolutely.
And that's why I hope that when I'm writing my own stories, that I'm hoping that I'm causing people to think and causing people to, analyze, okay, well, why is this story like this? And why are those characters doing what they're doing? And is that good that they are doing that? And is
I think as Christian authors, creators, we should do that. Like in my book, oh my gosh, I just said my book. I wrote a book, A Crazy Circus World, and it is a fantasy. And even though it's a children's book, there was a definite worldview in mind. Now, I didn't just sit there and go, I'm going to make sure this message comes out. It was just the natural progression of who I am. And the truth is not every piece of art that you do or create is going to be the same, but your body of work should reflect who you are and what you believe. Your body of work.
Yeah. And and some things will have more of an overt message than others. And a lot of that means being true to your story and being true to yourself. That's one thing I teach people is, when you're writing, you need to be true to your story, and in being true to your story, you're being true to yourself, and, right. and being true then to your God, which really is what it comes down to, is when I write a story, I want it to honor God, even if it's a one-page story about, just some goofy guys doing something goofy. Well, am I mm-hmm. dishonoring God with that story or not?
Right, and definitely.
Do you guys recognize the fact that our last comments are always really long?
I made my last comment. I'm commenting on your last comment. This is
exactly.
So then it wasn't your last comment.
No.
Steve, what about you, man?
I want to sum it up by just reading very quickly what J.R.R. Tolkien said about what a successful fairy tale does or exhibits, and make a comment on that. Basically, in his view, and this is someone who had a deep understanding of the whole thing, it revolves around these three things: recovery of the appreciation of the simple and humble things in our world, the escape from one's narrow and distorted view of the world, and the consolation that leads to a kind of joy even in the face of continuing evil in the world. So you have recovery of simple things, the escape from narrow-mindedness, and the consolation of joy even in the face of continuing evil. And interestingly, you can sort of see how Christianity plays into that paradigm, where you're recovering the simple and humble things in the world. You know, God uses the humble things, the baser things, to show his glory and escape from the narrow and distorted view of the world. You're escaping from, you know, that sense of whatever. It could be cynicism, it could be whatever. And then you have that consolation, that joy that is a gift from God. Real, true joy is a gift from God. And in the face of continuing evil, we continue through our lives, and we will until the end of, when God ends time. So you have those three elements playing in both fairy tales and in Christianity.
That's a good place for us to end this conversation, except we're not done with the episode, because we need to open up the mailbag.
Mailbag.
It's not a female bag.
Steve. Sorry. Had to get that in there, didn't you? Hey, we got a lot of comments about our Star Wars episodes. And so I wanted us to kind of address some of them and present some of them as well, maybe without like commentary. But we've got some of these, and some of them are really long. And so we're not going to be able to read your entire message. We apologize for that. But we wanted to get
We read them and we thank you for them.
We do read all of them, and yeah. I try to reply to as many as I can possibly reply to.
I didn't realize that I was going to stir up such a hornet's nest when I did my blog on Star Wars.
How could you not have thought?
And some of these comments actually are commenting on Dr. Jace's list. Some of these are commenting on the episodes, and some of them are commenting on a little bit of both. So those of you who sent us your own list, we're not going to give like your entire order or enlist and that sort of thing. But I did want to start with Randy, who wrote to us. Randy said, "I'm chill with that order," talking about Dr. Jace's order. He said, "I would argue that Anakin in episode 2 is supposed to be immature and whiny. That's why he falls to the dark side and temptations of Palpatine." So, yeah.
Yeah, he's pretty much just commenting because one of the things I said about episode 2 was that it was very distracting how whining Anakin is. So it's true. I mean, he does have a good point that yes, an immature and whiny individual is more likely to go to the dark side. I just found it slightly difficult to empathize with the character in episode 2.
Yeah. And taking the character from episode 1, who is a young boy who is making the best of what he has. He, you know, works. He tinkers on his little land speeder, glorified land speeder there, and he's every single thing. You know, go do this, yippee! And you know, being with his mom and everything. And now he's in this greater world. And what does he do? He whines and complains.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? What don't you get to do? That you have a lightsaber
did
now.
We,
you have
did we
all
mention
cool
by
stuff?
The way? Did we talk about how he built C-3PO? And so that every time C-3PO says in the original trilogy, thank the maker, he's saying, thank Darth Vader.
Thank Darth Vader.
So, well, and then there's
the next one is Eric Bone. He says, I completely agree with these, which I guess was my list.
Yeah.
I honestly have no problem with the way this is set up. However, in episode one, you forgot to mention the awesomeness of Natalie Portman. Just a personal preference. Eric Bone, young man. I actually know this young man, which is very interesting because we get another comment about Natalie Portman, which is completely the opposite. But yeah. What about Gary Volker? Do you want to?
Steve, you want to take that one?
Sure. Gary Volker said, I didn't hate 3, but I definitely don't see it as number 2 in the saga. Number 2 in ranking.
In Dr. Jace's list, yeah.
Right. Sure, there's cool scenes in all of the films. I guess I have a tendency to judge each film based on how it worked overall.
Although that's how Dr. Jace was right. kind of judging them as well. So
Gary's a friend of Ben and I's, and he definitely has an informed opinion. So he definitely has cred.
Yeah.
Even though he's wrong.
So speaking of credibility, the next our next one is from Josh. He says, "Well, I have a hard time."
You have to clarify this.
Well,
is
it's
brother.
Right there. It's right the first line. Yeah. Well, I have a hard time admitting this, but Jace is my brother. His list sickens me. Our mother is in a corner crying somewhere. Okay, first off, Empire is the greatest ever. Second, A New Hope. Yes, there are flaws, but the flaws are what make the movies so great. Quoting the movie fanboys, the crappy puppets and models are what make the movie. Without A New Hope, there is no Empire. Third, Jedi. Yes, the Ewoks were creepy and awkward to look at. Lucas did employ little people, and that's cool in my book. It would have been cool to have the Ewoks sing about their lollipop guild. Also, Jedi gave Vader redemption. That's good enough for me. Fourth, 3. I enjoyed seeing Yoda go all Jet Li and Hayden Christensen reveal to the world how terrible of an actor he truly is. I mean, even Paul Walker thought it was terrible.
Oh, no.
I can't even really say anything about episodes 1 and 2. The worst part of these films are Jar Jar Binks and George Lucas saying to himself, how can I ruin my greatest achievement? Oh, he did that again with Indy.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones and the
refrigerator of skull doom, thingy. Yeah. Wasn't it?
Really, my mom left the corner and is now trying to find out what she has to do to change her name because of my brother's tragic list.
Wow. Well, Mom, in most states, all you have to do is notify everyone who has your name that you have a new legal name. But check with your local laws.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I actually respond.
Wait, we can't give legal advice on this. We have to.
I'm giving legal advice. Yeah, I did respond to my brother's comment, and he and I both know that the reason my mom wants to change her last name is not because of this list, but because my brother Josh is a Gilmore Girls fan.
Whoa! Right? Whoa.
So in my book,
in
my book, the fact that my brother is a Gilmore Girls fan negates anything he has to say. It just basically is wah, 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 Gilmore Girls is good, therefore nothing makes sense.
Wow. I can't believe you're hating on Gilmore Girls like that.
Hey, we're going to have to do a Gilmore Girls episode.
All right. Well, Dr. Jace, you want to take the next one here?
Sure. This is from Andrew. All right, Dr. Jace. I think this might be one of my students. I think, yes, it is Andrew. All right, Dr. Jace. I finally found this blog post again. Now, I forgot that number 2 was Revenge of the Sith. But I can overlook that because personally I agree that it was one of the best films and most redemptive of all the prequels. However, in what galaxy far, far away is Phantom Menace better than Return of the Jedi, which we've talked at nauseam about. So, Steve, why don't you take on Sarah's?
Okay. I'll try to do this with a slightly feminine accent.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, don't please don't.
Are you saying that I normally have a feminine accent, so I shouldn't even worry about it? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that we really, your old values from your old school days.
That's where you're going.
Yeah, we don't want to insult Sarah.
Yeah.
Okay. Out of the entire saga, Empire Strikes Back was the only one that I couldn't watch the whole way through. Yep, I went there. I personally did not care for it that much. I put Revenge of the Sith first, even though Hayden Christensen's acting made me want to claw my eyes out with his horrible acting. But let's be honest here. The acting wasn't much better in the older ones either. It's a good thing we didn't watch these movies for the acting, eh? Anyways, this is how I'd put it. Number one, Revenge of the Sith. Number two, Attack of the Clones. Number three, Return of the Jedi. Number four, Phantom Menace. Number five, A New Hope. Number six, Empire Strikes Back.
And I wanted to include her list, although we're not doing it for some of the others, because it's so different from anyone's Star Wars list I've ever seen in my entire existence on Earth.
It hurt even reading it.
No. Sarah is a very intelligent student of mine. And I'll just tell you, this is just an example of how the younger viewers, a lot of them, unless they're classic Star Wars people and they know and they grew up knowing a lot of the younger ones, I'm telling you, view the films very differently, which leads me to Victoria, who is another one of my students. Now, Victoria actually did in one of my classes, she did a whole speech on Star Wars that opened up with lightsaber sounds and Darth Vader voices and stuff like that. So she's very well versed in Star Trek or Star Wars. So Ben, why don't you take that one?
Yeah, it says, I'm actually pretty fine with this list. Mine looks different, but I see why you put them where you did. My rankings: Empire, you can't beat it, pure awesome. Two, Return of the Jedi. Okay, so I like Ewoks. They're short, furry ninja warriors. I grew up wishing I was Leia kidnapped on Endor. Don't judge.
Wow.
Three, Sith. Again, very high. This is Ben, by the way. I'm mentioning that this is, again, very high on the list. Sith. Yeah. I liked seeing all the pieces finally put together. Jedi battles definitely make the movie, though. And I totally agree with you about the dialogue. Example: Anakin, you're breaking my heart. Because of Obi-Wan? Fail. Four, A New Hope, classic. Five, Phantom. Love Qui-Gon, the pod race, and Darth Maul, but Natalie Portman needs to go back to acting school.
Wow.
And don't even get me started on Jar Jar. Six, Attack of the Clones. You know, I love the whole changeling chase in the beginning, Kamino, and from the arena execution scene on, it was great. Like, amazing. It almost makes up for the emotional sappiness of the rest of it. Almost.
Almost.
Oh, no.
Yeah, okay, well, that leads us into some of the longer missives that we received. We got a number of emails from Tom Holst.
I'm sorry, I don't think they qualify as emails. I think after 20 pages, it equals as like a short novel.
Yeah, well, he actually, Tom Holst went back and listened to every single one of our episodes and actually sent us comments on every single one. We're only going to...
Tom Holst rocks.
We're only going to focus on his Star Wars comments for this episode, for this edition of the Mailbag. Dr. Jace, you want to go ahead and read some of this? I'm going to interrupt you in the middle here, but
I actually don't.
You don't? Okay. Steve, you want
No, I'll do it.
Sure, I don't care.
I'm a friend of Ben's, which makes sense, through Facebook. We both went through Act One, although not at the same time. I saw his link for the podcast and I saw about the Star Wars prequels. I know I had to listen. For most part, I agreed almost entirely with Ben, of course. And usually with Steve, and pretty much never, ever agreed with Dr. Joyce. Okay, Tom.
Dr. Joyce.
Tom, you and I need to talk.
I don't agree with Dr. Joyce either. So
Dr. Jace. It's a guy named Jace, not Joyce. All right. All right.
Anyway, he goes on to talk about some of the – he has 2 points about the prequel. Actually, he had 8 points about the prequels. We're going to mention two of them. To wit, he says, defending the prequels by saying they're made for kids and we just don't get it because we're grumpy adults now, that's complete nonsense. One comment he made was, the Toy Story movies are also made for kids. I saw them as an adult and enjoyed them as an adult because they're well-made movies. And then he says, defending the prequels as kids' movies falls apart with the genocide of Jedi and murder of children in Revenge of the Sith. Although...
We're not talking about toddlers. We're talking about the big demographics of kids from teenagers and to 25.
And also, Revenge of the Sith is a PG-13 movie. I think Phantom Menace is what people are talking about when they talk about it's a kids movie.
And we're not arguing that it's a well-made kids movie. We're just saying that the way that George Lucas geared a lot of the stuff and the humor was very geared towards like a 10-year-old type of humor.
But I think I made this point,
in poo and things like that.
But I think I made this point is that I can enjoy a well-made children's movie.
Right.
I really can. And so that's not, I don't think it's...
Well, I think it's impossible. And I'll just say this. I think it's impossible for anybody who saw the original series in the theaters, I think it's impossible for them to be objective in these new movies because it was their childhood, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I'll disagree with it simply because
I disagree that it's impossible, though, because
I think it's impossible. I would say this because you have an emotional attachment to it. Even if I disagree with Steve, like, I can't really argue because he's talking about how he felt about the movie.
Right.
I think that it's like saying that someone's personal value system doesn't influence their decisions. That's impossible. They do.
Right.
In movies, you can't divorce your personal feelings and experiences with them totally and be completely objective. I think you can
be objective, though. And I would like to think that I am. But obviously, you guys don't think I am. But
No, our listeners don't either.
If these movies didn't impact you the way they impacted some people, if this was just another movie you saw in 1977, and then you happened to see it, the other one in 1980 and 1983, and we're like, oh, yeah, okay, I see a lot of movies, you know, science fiction being some of it, et cetera, and then moved on to the, oh, wow, he's doing prequels to the movies that he made back then. Oh, this will be interesting.
But
for geeks, for nerds, for people like us, it's difficult to get out of that.
We need to move on to the next part, but yeah. You kept saying how strongly you identified with Luke, And then in the new movies, you were talking about how much you wanted, you know, this relationship to be different in that relationship. And so from that perspective, you're coming at it from your first experience.
No, I'm not, though. I'm coming at it from a storytelling perspective. I'm coming at it from what I know about character development and character and interaction and engaging story. And yeah. I don't think I really hope that that's what I'm coming from, because that's what I'm telling myself that I'm coming from. In other words, I'm just completely deluded that I'm like looking at this movie and saying, you know what, this doesn't work because this relationship, the payoff is not earned. And I do the same thing with other movies as well.
I'm not saying that your view, what I'm saying is that I'm not saying you can't be any kind of objective. I'm just saying you can't help but be influenced by it. I just don't think it's possible for anybody to be not influenced. You know, if there's a movie that I saw, you know, when I saw Star Wars, it's going to influence how I view, you know, anyways. But that's neither here nor there. What's the next one?
Well, he goes on to say, even George Lucas doesn't seem to know what the story that he wanted to tell. So many setups were not paid off. What about the chips inside the slave's head that makes them blow up if they try to escape? That concept was thrown out there in Phantom Menace and abruptly abandoned. What about Anakin's dream of coming back to free the slaves, also in The Phantom Menace? What about the whole romantic subplot in Episode 2 about Anakin breaking the Jedi Code by marrying Padme? There's this massive buildup that the whole second movie is about, and we wait for Anakin to get in trouble in the third movie, and then nothing. Obi-Wan quickly dismisses it with one line in Episode 3, indicating he knows already and apparently doesn't mind, rendering all of Episode 2 completely meaningless. So to use the argument about any plot point, George had his story he was determined to tell, doesn't work with me. I don't think George was even awake when he made the prequels.
Yeah, there's so many holes, so many missed opportunities, and some of them are just softball lobs. I mean, just...
And then he says, I'm saying this not because I'm a hater, quite the contrary. It's because I love Star Wars so much that I won't accept these inferior imitations, even if the original creator was involved. I quote my friend Randy Dannensfelder, quote, if Phantom Menace had really been the first Star Wars movie, there wouldn't have been a second.
Wow.
Which I almost agree with, but I think it was – I think it would have still made enough money to have warranted a –
Well,
I would argue a different way and say that Phantom Menace never would have been the first Star Wars movie because he never intended to start with that unless he could tell, you know, all six movies worth of stuff in one film, which he couldn't. So he took the best of what he had and put out A New Hope.
And Tom sent a couple other emails, but I wanted to do one last comment from his third email to us, which was actually responding to our episode about the original trilogy. And he says, the only thing that works in all of the movies is John Williams' score.
Yes.
I own all three of the prequel scores. Anakin's theme from Phantom Menace says far more about the potential for good and the potential for evil in all of us than anything else in the prequels. And that is something we didn't really talk about, is John Williams' music in these movies is phenomenal. And of anything else, I do agree that John Williams' music got better between episode 4, the first movie, and episode 3, the last of the films. It's
John Williams is amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, he just is amazing. I wish he could score every movie I've ever seen. He's just so good.
Yeah. Back in 1977, 78, I spent many an hour sitting with my little record player because I had the double record set, and I would play these over and over again.
I remember listening to the Phantom Menace soundtrack when I was writing Armor Quest, and it was so cool because the music changed just as the scene's emotions in my own story as I was writing changed, and it changed so pitch perfect.
It's really good, yeah.
So I will say this. I've been listening to the Indiana Jones soundtracks, all four of those, and I'm almost enjoying those more lately than the Star Wars one, which is interesting. Well, all right, Dr. Jace.
Tom obviously, agreed mostly with Ben, which is not surprising. They're buddies. I'm sure Ben paid him to write all those things. But anyway,
so he also came up.
He and I never met in person, though. We happened. We're in an email group from the same writing program that we went to in Los Angeles. So
he also came up with some
fantastic instances of lapses in logic. So if you can go back and read some of the stuff that he wrote there, it's.
I've read it. I still disagree with him. Anyway,
on to this guy though, Student Z.
Student Z, which is the one we've been talking about throughout the thing, which we didn't even include some of his comments because some of them were so grateful that he commented.
His commenting. And students A through Y really have to step up.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, so it says this. It says, let's see here. Student Z, he goes, no offense to my elders, but Dr. Jace is 100% correct. Smart kid. Those making an argument that the original movies are far better than the new trilogy has to do with pure sentiment. Yes, the original movie started it all, but on the grounds of storytelling, the second trilogy is just as strong.
Let him read it. Let him read it.
The Phantom Menace mirrors Star Wars in that Luke turns off his equipment and goes with his gut and destroys the Death Star. Anakin tries to shoot those shooting at him and blows up the mothership. Both are not skilled fighters, but then they take out the bad guys.
Wrong.
But at least Anakin's is more believable.
No.
Okay,
I can't let that one go by.
Okay. My opinion, Star Wars beats Phantom Menace simply because it was the one that started it all, not because it was so much better. Clones beats Empire. This is the one thing that I agree with on Steve. Empire is depressing. Sith crushes Jedi. Jedi is the worst movie of the group. On this point, Dr. Jace is right on. So the new movies beat the old movies 2-1. I watched all of the movies when I was a kid, and I love the new ones way better. Ben says that the first three have a better storytelling. Please, Ewoks, snow creatures that look so fake, and uber thin storyline in the original Star Wars.
Yeah, so Steve, I know where you're going because both Anakin and Luke are skilled pilots.
Yeah, how can he say that they're not skilled fighters? And the problem with that saying that they mirror each other is that Luke actually relies on his skill to get him to the point where he can use the Force to destroy the Death Star. And
not skilled fighters because they've never been battle tested, not because they're not pilots, because they obviously both were, but not being skilled fighters is different than being skilled pilots.
Yeah, but he used to hit womp rats that were no bigger than that 2 meter exhaust.
It was 216 back home.
So it doesn't matter though.
Darth Vader breathing down on his back.
That's a miter. Well, that's true. Well, but he had Han Solo taking his.
He didn't know that.
Han Solo got rid of Vader, and then he had the chance to take the shot.
Not till the end. In the situations, both he's just basically the kid is just. I mean, I'm assuming it's a kid. Is just drawing the conclusion that these guys, whether or not they were trained or not, they're not battle tested. They're not skilled fighters. They're both kids, basically.
And it doesn't matter, though, because it really, I'm accepting of Luke's. Anakin's, I'm not just because of it, just feels accidental to me.
Yeah.
But I can see, and you made the point too, Dr. Jace, that Anakin's was more believable. Because it was the accidental, I think, is what Student Z is trying to say here.
I don't understand that logic.
Well, he doesn't understand your logic either, Steve. So, so anyway, I did want to talk about the Ewoks and the Thin story. And I have to say that part of this, I think, maybe is me being forgiving because of the time. As far as, you know, the fake snow creature, I went with this fake snow creature because, you know what? There wasn't anything better than that on screens anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, the original trilogy was groundbreaking as far as effects went, but right. it does, the effects are dated. Right. And that's why he went back and did his special editions and everything
and,
with that.
And so I think that when these younger people come to see these movies, for them, those things, and because we keep talking about storytelling, from what I've heard in classes and discussing, it's hard for them to get beyond it because it looks so fake to them. And that it's kind of like the conclusion. If you look at old acting, like from the black and white era and comedies and stuff, everything is so large. Well, nowadays, people think that it's horrible acting because everything's so big. They don't understand the history of how acting has become. Now we're kind of in this naturalistic, realistic kind of genre. So they can't view it. They can't view the old Star Wars through a lens that that the older generation can view it from, because they're viewing it from, hey, okay, this puppet is fake. So it draws them out of the story and it doesn't, you know, it ruins the plot points for them because they can't buy into it. Now, anyway.
Well, and he then says, and I cut this out of the script, but I went back and found his message, said, it's not a matter of better, but a matter of taste. Which is something we've gone over a lot. The old guys need to get over it, he then says. which kind of goes against what he just said about not being a matter of better or a matter of taste. But but then he says their grand old tales aren't better. They were just first. And I would then counter with the grand old tale or the grand new tales aren't better. They were just newer. I get, though, why people would say, you know what, the effects just aren't as good. I do have a problem with George Lucas putting out the Blu-ray without the original cuts of these movies, because they are pieces of cinematic history as far as they created special effects and created technology to make the movies work, not mm-hmm. the other way around. It wasn't them going and saying, okay, we have this technology. How can we use the technology to make this story? They created technology to make the stories work, which then got used throughout, you know, the next few decades.
Right. It's chronological snobbery. I think C.S. Lewis said chronological snobbery, when, you know, the newest thing is the better thing. And you really have to put it into a context. And I don't care if you like the new ones better than the old ones. I don't care if you like the old ones better than the new ones. You need to get out of the mindset that, you know, and old people need to get out of the same mindset.
Because the old is chronological better. Snobbery does go both ways.
Yes, it does. That's absolutely true. Yeah. But one, I actually just saw these comments that it's not actually on our list of things to read, but I think they're hilarious, Ben.
Oh, they're on our list.
They're on the Jar Jar one?
Yeah, they're on the list. We'll get to that in just a second here.
I didn't see that.
I copied and pasted, so they should be. But anyway, I was going to say is I will say this. I defend the Ewoks, and I defend the decision to have them in the Return of the Jedi. I do agree the execution of how they were used, and Dr. Jace's example of the magic rock that knocks down and knocks out two stormtroopers, he's got a good point. Although on the flip side, if you take the Ewoks made-for-TV movies that came out after Return of the Jedi, you saw the Ewoks actually did have magical powers and talismans, and maybe that was an actual magical rock. But when I look at the story, and I tend to watch movies for what they are intended to be, and that we'll get into that later as far as some movies that I'm very forgiving to that I probably shouldn't, because I look at it and see, oh, this is what the filmmakers wanted it
to be. But if he had done. My issue with the Ewoks is not the concept. Like, some people have an issue because they just basically took the Wookiees and made them small.
Well, but, Ewoks, Wookiee. Yeah. I mean, come on. He didn't even try.
My issue was with the execution. I have no problem with these fuzzy, you know, little things running around, but I thought the execution was horrible. That was my main issue with them.
Yeah, I do admit there are moments, but at the same time, I'm okay with it somewhat because of the what it's trying to be. And, you know, it's basically, that's Avatar, the movie right there. Avatar is Ewoks versus Empire.
No, no. Yeah, Avatar is basically Dances with Wolves mixed in with that.
Fern Gully.
Yeah.
Okay, so a buddy of mine from high school, I mentioned this guy actually in our first episode about friends that I had in high school when I moved to a different school. This is from Gordon. He says, I also agree with your assessment of the prequel trilogy in that Attack of the Clones should have been first, with slight modifications, followed by a new second movie about the middle of the Clone Wars. The biggest disappointment for me in Attack of the Clones was that the Clone Wars barely started when the credits rolled, and were almost over when Revenge of the Sith started. Cop out, says I. The whole Phantom Menace thing should have been handled as a prologue to the true trilogy, if shown at all. Right. I never quite got past the believability factor that a 9-year-old could pilot a racing pod, much less a starship, or that his mother could in good conscience send her 9-year-old off to some other planet for the rest of his life to somebody they had just met the day before. Talk about irresponsibility and unfit to be a parent.
You're getting metaslavery,
I think she
though.
Was just waiting to offload the little brat on the first space cruiser that came her way so she could run off to the night scene on Tatooine to meet a certain Mr. Lars. I also think that the story would have been much stronger had Anakin been more Luke's age when Obi-Wan met him, and Anakin's training occurred completely outside the auspices of the Jedi Order to match better with the dialogue from Return of the Jedi.
Right.
The concept would also mesh well with the modifications to the story timeline mentioned earlier. So that's my buddy Gordon.
I think Gordon's really worked up. I think he might need to see someone for that.
he makes a point, but on the other hand, you know, they were slaves, and so getting your son out of a life of slavery is...
He's a Jedi, so you trust the Jedi.
Assuming he really is what he says he is.
Ask him to move something with his mind.
All right, Dr. Jace, you want to take on this next message that came to us from a galaxy... Far, far away.
Ben, are you going to do the Ewok?
I'll do the next one, and Steve can do the interpretation of that one. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to try this. Someone wrote in as Jar Jar, and it's pretty funny. I don't know if I can do this well, but this is from Jar Jar. Methinks you Zals are means to me. I's a fine actor and an admiral was, are ya? Me thinks you's all jealous of my good looks. George Lucas rocks, and so does the Binks.
I don't.
That's hilarious.
Yeah,
that's good.
And I'm pretty sure that wasn't actually Jar Jar, because I don't think Jar Jar can type with his huge fingers. But this one, this one came from someone with the technological ability of of a caveman or whatever, but Ewok number 14 wrote in and said,
"The interpretation. Thank the heavens for Jar Jar Binks, who has freed us from the terrible stigma of being George Lucas' worst creation."
Ewok 14 goes on to say, "Ooh ah, ooh ah."
And the interpretation. Dr. Jace thinks my mini bear power can't overtake 3 overrated stormtroopers, but I say fooey. Not only can my koala-like skills take out a whole troop of stormtroopers, but I could take out Dr. Jace with both eyes tied behind my back.
And I think there's really no argument with that last statement.
If George Lucas was right in the movie, you're absolutely right.
So we want to thank you guys for listening once again. I'm Ben, and with me are...
Steve.
Dr. Jace.
Toe stepping perfect, my plan worked. You couldn't have done that better if I asked you to.
You're welcome.
You did ask us to.
Well, you know what I mean. So,
and still keep writing, guys. Also, keep writing on our website, and we'll keep doing these shows and cool mailbags. And God bless you all.
The Beats.
Hey, thanks for listening, and Godspeed. You've been listening to the Strangers and Aliens podcast, hosted by Ben Avery, Dr. Jace O'Neill, and Steve McDonald. Our music was composed and mixed by Tim Leffel. We invite you to join the conversation by visiting our website, www.strangersandaliens.com, where you'll find show notes, articles, reviews, and more. You can also follow us on Twitter, where we are at Strange and Alien, or like us on our Facebook page. If you'd like to email us directly, our email is podcast@strangersandaliens.com. And once again, thanks for listening. Ooh, ooh,